of upcoming talks in this series. So next week we have Slava Duration, which is going to be experimental gravity related. This is, I think, related to the issue of the Pioneer Anomaly and future proposals for future experiments. Then we have Kai Zuber with neutrino astronomy, and talk about high energy neutrino astronomy and so forth, which, as you see, is not necessarily is a topic that's heating up, and so we're interested in it. Then I talk about geometry and physics of proteins, the giant fatal particles of condensed matter physicists who have gone over more and more into physics of biology. And then Jim Hartle, his work with Mike Delmon and other people on generalized quantum mechanics. I also want to mention, this is something that some people know about, but just to emphasize, we start next Thursday night a new social feature at Perimeter, which is the Perimeter Cabaret. And that will be about once a month on some Thursday nights. And the idea explicitly here is to bring people from here, scientists and other people working at Perimeter, to meet creative people from outside the building in all kinds of arts, music, and so forth. And we start with Colleen Huxenbow, who is part of what I'm told is a very famous Canadian independent rock group, Heather Von Wright, with her own duo. And the idea is just to get together and have fun. It's free. Bring your friends, invite your friends, and so forth. Well, it's very, very nice to have Jana within today. We have been inviting Jana for more than 4 years to come up. We are welcoming her back to Canada, with somebody who spent part of her postdoctoral years in Toronto. Jana is hard to classify. She was sort of started out as a cosmologist, but she has worked in astrophysics, in relativity, in a variety of things. She also had a very interesting and successful popular book on astronomy, and she has a novel coming out next year. And we're very, very happy to have her here. She's now at Columbian Barnum. We're very happy to have her here to talk about chaos and general relativity.
Oh, I have to turn it on, sorry. Am I on? I'm mic'd up? Well, it's very exciting to be here. I kept trying to wait for the perfect trip when I could come for, you know, 2 weeks or a month or something. I'm here for less than 24 hours, but it's a start. Did something just go wrong at the last second? So I really had a hard time deciding what to talk about. I know Lee's prepped me that you're all theorists. Everyone here is probably an expert at some level or another at general relativity or particle physics. And so you're a tough audience. You know, you're a tough audience. And I had a hard time deciding what to talk about. But I honed in on something that I've been working on more recently, which is black hole dynamics, black hole binary dynamics. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I got there, and then we'll talk about chaos theory and why I love it so, why I think it's so interesting, and its application to black holes. But I really started working on this many years ago with a student of John Moffitt's, Neil Cornish. And Neil Cornish was doing some really interesting work in chaos theory and general relativity. And I remember at the time feeling kind of bored. I mean, I really started working on it because I was just looking for something interesting to work on, just that was kind of fun at first. And yet this had very deep theoretical implications. It sort of took on a life of its own. So one of the things that Neil and I looked at was an anisotropic Big Bang model. Now, we all know the model of the Big Bang. The story that's told is that you have this homogeneous and isotropic expansion out of the Big Bang. But of course, that's not really what we think the Big Bang looked like. It was probably a much more generic event. And there were groups, especially in Russia, where people were looking at a generic singularity. And actually, the history of it, I won't dwell on it for too long, was that people thought maybe singularities could be avoided altogether if you removed some of these special symmetries. This was before the Hawking-Penrose singularity theorems, where people were saying, maybe if I looked at an inhomogeneous model, a model where the different dimensions of space were each doing their own thing, I would avoid singularities altogether. But what it led to was indeed a real singularity. It did not go away, but it was a more generic picture of a singularity, including inside a black hole. And interestingly, people started to discover that it looked chaotic. And I'll talk more about exactly what I mean by chaos in a few minutes. But the problem is, for about 15 years, people couldn't really come up with an unambiguous way of discussing chaos in general relativity. So some people said it is, some people said it isn't. Some measures of chaos would disappear in different coordinate systems. So this debate went on for a very long time, and Neil and I were able to resolve this by looking at fractal sets. So I'll also talk about fractals. And that was very exciting, but it seems so theoretical that, you know, three people got really excited about it. Like, I got invited to Kladikov's fest trip in Moscow. You know, that was a big thing that happened. But it turned out to be a generic feature of a lot of relativistic systems that you had chaotic phenomena. And another classic example in dynamical systems theory is the geodesic flows on a compact hyperbolic manifold. And this is known to be ergodic. A lot of chaos was found in this. It's been studied also as a quantum chaotic system, a lot of fascinating properties. But it could also apply to the entire universe. The universe could be a compact hyperbolic space, in which case the actual geodesic flows of light and matter on this universe could show chaotic properties. And that means you could see chaos even in, let's say, the spectrum of density fluctuations. It's conceivable. So it tends to show up in a lot of relativistic systems. Or this could be compact extra dimensions. Or it could be a variety of other things that are relativistically relevant. Another system in which we found chaos is the simplest thing you can think of, which is coupled scalar fields. You can find chaos in oscillations of color degrees of freedom in a Yang-Mills theory, or you can find chaos in a hybrid model of inflation. And more recently, I've been working with some grad students at Columbia who are looking at moduli fields in string theory that are non-linearly coupled to each other, in which we're seeing chaotic phenomena. Now, the problem with all this, a lot of it can be analytically very beautiful, and so I thought maybe I should talk about one of these topics, since everyone's a theorist, and we like to see people do things analytically. The problem is that I've not yet found really great phenomenological consequences of the chaos. So far, this has all been kind of aesthetically pleasing and theoretically pleasing, but I didn't solve, you know, just there weren't physical problems that were necessarily resolved by that. Until I started looking at black hole pairs. And it's not a surprise that in the dynamics of black hole pairs you might find chaos, although it is kind of a surprise because we've all think we know how to find orbits around black holes. And I'll tell you why we don't really know how to find orbits around black holes, and why chaos does show up in black hole binary systems. And this is much more physically relevant because we know there are black hole pairs out there. I mean, I use the word "know" loosely. We've never seen a black hole pair because they're dark. We've seen black holes with other objects like a luminous companion or an accretion disk or in the centers of galaxies. But what we're really seeing is an electromagnetic counterpart to the black hole. We're not actually getting in close enough to see things that are characteristic of black holes, like the innermost unstable orbits and features that are smoking gun signals in black holes. But we suspect that they're out there, black hole pairs, and in fact, we think that they're going to be very important for future gravitational wave experiments. So the fact that chaos shows up in the dynamics here is suddenly astrophysically relevant, it's measurable, it's something in the future, hopefully, and so it's something that we really need to face. And then I'm going to say something that's going to sound, well, this is okay. So the gist being that general relativity is vulnerable to chaos. And that's maybe not that big of a surprise. General relativity is a highly nonlinear theory, and chaos is just kind of a cooler name for nonlinear dynamics. So it's maybe not a big surprise that if we confront some of these problems face on, we find chaos in a lot of relativistic systems. And then this is the slightly stupid thing I'm going to say. The thing that I've been interested in for a long time, every couple of years I mumble something about this to Lee, but I never get any deeper about it. I still haven't honed in on this issue at all. But I wondered if chaos couldn't be fundamental. That is, we often think of chaos in grungy physical systems, and we do not think that it is the realm of fundamental physics, that it's an applied tool, not a fundamental tool. And yet we know that gravity is a highly nonlinear theory to the point of being extremely resistant to classical, or canonical rather, quantization attempts and unification attempts. And even though we've had great progress on those fronts, there's no doubt that the nonlinearity of general relativity is saying something to us about its fundamental nature. And so I've always been curious if there couldn't be some deeper connection to quantum chaos. And other than saying something touchy-feely, I don't really know what more to say about that, but I thought this would be a great audience to say something like that. Maybe somebody there will have that eureka moment, will know some piece of a puzzle, put it into a better context. So also feel free to interrupt so I don't just plow through. Chaos, if you look at chaotic systems, if you open up any kind of textbook on chaos, you'll be hard-pressed to find so much as a definition of the term. And that's because it's kind of hard to pin down. I have a really excellent book on chaos, and it will say something like, chaos means sensitivity to initial conditions. But that is not a sufficient description. If you think of De Sitter space, a universe that's exponentially expanding, I could have two trajectories on that space which will exponentially deviate away from each other as they follow the expansion of the universe, but there's nothing chaotic going on. That's showing some kind of exponential sensitivity to initial condition. But but it's not formally chaotic. So there's actually a deeper meaning to chaos, and that really has to do with integrability. So there is a formal meaning, although not all of these meanings are completely overlapped. But the formal meaning is really about integrability. Chaotic systems are not formally integrable. It means if I write down a list of ODEs, I cannot find an analytic solution which will interpolate between different orbits. And that is not just because people aren't clever enough, it's because there do not exist smooth analytic functions that interpolate between different initial conditions. So what do I mean by integrability? That understanding will actually lead to a physical picture. So integrability is something we're all trained in. We're all very thoroughly trained in theoretical physics. You look for symmetries, and when you find those symmetries, you're able to integrate your set of equations. So for instance, if I had a Hamiltonian system, everybody knows Hamilton's equations. I would have n coordinates, q, and their n conjugate, and that's a p. And in that Hamiltonian system, if there were n symmetries, I could find n constants of motion, and it's well known that that would allow me to perform a canonical transformation on these coordinates so that I could choose what's called action angle variables, where I could align my new momenta under my canonical transformation, each one with one of my symmetries, with one of my constants of motion. And I would be left with simply angular variables, where the coordinate would simply execute periodic motion with a constant momentum. So you always know you have a solution if you have a certain amount of symmetry. So symmetry is very tied to the idea of being able to find solutions to equations of motion. So let's say I do have a Hamiltonian system with n constants, n coordinates. Let's say it's a system of two coordinates and two conjugate momenta. In the action angle variables, motion would simply lie along a circle in one direction and a circle in the other direction. And that leads to motion on the surface of a torus. And that's very common. Anytime you have an integrable solution, you might not be used to looking for it this way. It might be interesting to you to actually look for it this way, but you will be able to prove that the motion is confined to an n-dimensional torus. And it's interesting to note that there are special sets of orbits. There are periodic orbits, orbits that execute a rational number of windings in one direction versus another direction. And they're very rare orbits. That is to say, most orbits will not wind exactly once around here as it winds once around the other direction. Most orbits will have irrational windings. But it turns out that even though they're a set of measure zero, they're a special set, those periodic orbits. So periodic orbits turn out to be kind of the structure of the whole thinking behind chaos. So the proofs are based in number theory, that you can always find a rational approximate to any irrational number, and you can make it arbitrarily close if you get a more refined rational number, if you continue fractional expansions. It's actually not that hard to prove that you can always be near a periodic orbit. So periodic orbits tend to come in, we'll just reduce it to two simple kinds that I was familiar with. We have simple, stable orbits. In other words, if I'm near a fixed point of the dynamics, like a circular orbit, and I perturb it, I'll simply move around that orbit, I'll oscillate around that orbit. And there are unstable orbits, where if I perturb it, I move away from that orbit. And we'll see this again in the context of black holes. And although they are, as I said, a set of measure zero, they're fundamental somehow to the dynamics of the phase space. The fascinating thing is that for a long time, particularly beginning of last century, people did not know what happened to this motion on a torus. If I started with a Hamiltonian that was perfectly integrable and regular under small perturbation, and this was during a time where people thought mostly systems were integrable, and the idea that you couldn't integrate a system was going to be very rare and very unlikely. And since then, things have really turned around, and it began with a theorem due to Kolmogorov, Arnold, and Moser, where they showed that under perturbation, a Hamiltonian that was perfectly integrable. Most of those tori would survive, but there was a complement set. That is to say, most of the motion would continue to remain integrable and regular, but there was a complement set where motion on the torus was destroyed. And that opened up a window for people to formally start to study chaos, where it was happening and why it was happening. And also Poincaré had many ideas on this that were resuscitated in the 1920s. Virchow resuscitated some of his ideas on this. Where what they showed was that if I started with a periodic orbit, one of these special rational windings on the torus, and I perturbed it, that periodic orbit would break up into even sets of more periodic orbits. So there would be a kind of resonance with this set of measure zero periodic orbits. And they would break up. That is to say, one periodic orbit would be replaced by a multiplicity of periodic orbits. And I would end up with equal numbers of stable fixed points and unstable fixed points under this perturbation. And then when I looked near an unstable orbit, I would find the possibility of something called a homoclinic tangle. And I'm not going to talk about it too much, but it's basically where an unstable direction and stable direction begin to intersect. And they intersect an infinite number of times. You can prove that if they intersect once, they must intersect an infinite number of times. And the reason why this picture is relevant is because if I'm on an ordinary orbit, and I'm just, let's say it's a pinball game, and I'm nowhere, I'm not exactly on a periodic orbit, but I will veer near one of those periodic orbits that you could draw on a pinball machine. And as it does so, it will be pushed away along an unstable direction from a fixed point, and it will be pushed towards it along a stable direction, but it'll quickly be knocked to another. Well, it will be pushed away and then pushed towards it, and it'll be knocked towards another. Well, it will be pushed away and pushed towards it. And what you end up having is that's where you generate the extreme sensitivity to initial conditions. So you're starting to see already that you're generating what people usually refer to physically as extreme sensitivity to initial conditions. But there's also something very interesting that each time I look around one of these stable periodic orbits, I would find a self-similar pattern of repeated structure of more fixed points, where that's also broken up under the perturbation. And then around those, I would also find more fixed points. So what you're seeing now is nested structures of periodic orbits and instability. And that is where you actually start to formally generate what's truly chaotic. And that will also lead to the idea of getting fractals. So this is all just very background-ish, and we'll talk about it in a more specific context. But if we're going to call symmetry integrable and the loss of symmetry non-integrable, it's really when we lose symmetry that we start to see chaos. And that's why I think it might one day have some fundamentally interesting implications if we're always in pursuit of fundamental theories based on what symmetry dictates the form of that theory. I think it's interesting to wonder, could anything emerge from a theory which actually lost symmetries, which actually didn't have a fundamental symmetry, but could there be something emergent like in the nature of fractal sets or entropies of that sort. Anyway, so how does this physically manifest itself? It comes out in an extreme sensitivity to initial conditions and a mixing and folding of trajectories. So when you have this kind of situation where your periodic orbits are breaking up into a fractal set of periodic orbits, what you end up with in your physical system is an extreme sensitivity to initial conditions and a mixing and folding of trajectories. And you could think, again, of the pinball game as being a pretty good example. If I play pinball, the whole game is based on the fact that it's chaotic. If I can't get that lever exactly the same initial condition each time, I always play a different game. If I could just adjust that lever slightly and be able to repeat the game each time, it would not be a chaotic system and also wouldn't really be a game. So the whole game is based on the fact that it's extremely sensitive to how I pull that lever back and exactly what initial condition the ball is given. And you could study all of it by studying the periodic orbits, the special set of periodic orbits that, whatever those things are called, that you could draw between the bumpers. And so in a lot of these settings, we're really looking at complicated billiard games or complicated games of pinball. Now, chaos does not mean we can know nothing about the system. It's a blend of order and disorder. And we do have a loss of predictability in the sense that it's difficult to follow orbits after a certain period of time. But some people confuse that with saying it's not deterministic, which is absurd. It's completely deterministic. Chaos is deterministic. In other words, I start with an initial condition. There's an exact answer to the outcome that a computer could generate if it had infinite precision. It just means that I can't write it down analytically. So there's a human loss of predictability, but the system's formally deterministic. But we do also get emergent things that allow us to talk about the system very clearly, things like fractal dimensions and entropies. And that's the same as in statistical mechanics. You don't say, I can know nothing about a system if it's thermal. You don't say that at all. You say quite the opposite. I know everything about a system if it's thermal, and I know a lot of it based just on the temperature. And so there's something similar here, where by looking at collections and groups, you can say a lot about what's going on. So what does all this have to do with the black hole problem? Well, it turns out that the two-body problem in general relativity is completely insoluble. I mean, maybe I'm overstating the case because it hasn't been proven yet, but let's put it this way. The two-body problem's never been solved in general relativity, and it resists all attempts at solution. It's resisted 25 years of numerical attempts at solution. What we do know, of course, everyone knows about Kepler's laws, and we know that planetary orbits lie on perfect ellipses, so we know the two-body problem in Newtonian mechanics, that if we have a Newtonian system, things lie on perfect ellipses. And we know that in general relativity, if I have a super, super light companion, let's say a planet around a star, where I can ignore the gravitational field of the companion, then in this test particle limit, I know that orbits precess relativistically. That's not really Mercury, is it? That's Mars. Does anyone know? Well, it's Mercury whose precession of the perihelion was measured to confirm the one of the experimental tests of Einstein's theory was that this precession of the perihelion of Mercury could not be confirmed until general relativity added the extra piece. I think it's 43 seconds of arc. Is it per year or per 100 years? Yeah, for 100 years. Okay.
Precession of the perihelion of Mars is being measured.
Okay, so here's Mars. And here's its measuring of succession pairing. Okay, so that's great. That's all very successful. But remarkably enough, we do not know what happens when I really have two bodies with serious gravitational effects around both the bodies and when both the bodies spin. And this picture is actually generated in an approximation of that, so I'll talk about that. And when you try to look at those systems, you will find chaos. Now, not everywhere. It's not swapping the whole phase space. You must have a nice Newtonian limit. You must have a nice precessing ellipse somewhere. But if you get in very, very close, where we're really probing what black holes look like deep in, you will start to see relativistic chaos. And that's just the two-body problem. So
it's just a question. The solar system is chaotic.
Yeah, that's great. So the three-body problem is chaotic in Newtonian mechanics.
But even just the existence of something like Jupiter,
which just makes it a three-body. Exactly. And Poincaré was studying this quite a lot. And Poincaré knew about these homoclinic tangles, and he knew about this fractal subperiodic orbits, although he didn't use those words. Because fractals weren't really coined until Mandelbrot. But the time scale for the chaos to set in the solar system is longer than, I think, the lifetime of the solar system, except for things like the rings of Saturn might be shepherded by chaotic phenomena, or in the Kuiper belt you see chaotic phenomena. But actually, the planetary orbits will be disrupted if you wait long enough. So time scales for the onset of chaos are important. I mean, if the chaos takes 14 billion years to turn on. In other words, if I measure the stability to the sensitivity to initial conditions, and it tells me that it only expresses after a very long time, then you don't see it for a very long time. So it is one of the relevant questions. Even if something's chaotic, will you see it, you know, if you're experimentally looking for it? But that's true. The three-body problem is chaotic, and that's why Poincaré had absolutely brilliant stuff about this. And a lot of it's rooted in number theory. So analytically, you can do some really beautiful stuff if you sit down with it. Although a lot of this has to be numerical in the end too. And the reason why this is not just another theoretical problem, not just a pretty problem, is because we have built gravitational wave observatories, both on Earth. Let me just draw one. Here's one on Earth. And there's one, as you know, proposed for space, the LISA experiment. This is LIGO. And the hope is that as these things orbit, they will generate gravitational waves that we can understand well enough that when the waves travel through the universe, essentially unimpeded, and they come to this gravitational wave observatory, that we will be able to measure the very small stretching and squeezing in space as the gravitational wave passes through the Earth. And remarkably, well, there's LIGO, there's LISA in space. Remarkably, these experiments rely heavily on theory. That is to say, if I point a telescope to the sky, I simply see a picture of the sky. It might be in a different wave band, but I can easily translate it actually to a picture. I just look out and I ask, what do I see? You can't do that in gravitational wave physics. It's more like listening for a sound, and a sound is extremely noisy, and unless you have a very clear filter, that is a theoretical filter, against which you can match this signal, you might not know you're seeing anything at all. So understanding the dynamics of these orbits, which generate the waves, is actually critical to the success of a lot of these experiments. And LISA may be a little bit less so, where the signal might be large enough that you can just hear it out of the noise, but certainly for the ground-based observatories. And so we know we have to understand very well theoretically, but you could also say maybe real black holes have simple orbits. Maybe they're never on these complicated orbits. But just to give you a bit of the background, we know that the largest population of black hole pairs that LIGO is looking for not on simple orbits. So you know the Hulse-Taylor pulsar. There's the famous experiment where Hulse and Taylor measured the gravitational radiation that would be emitted by a pulsar and correlated it with the spin-down period and showed that, in fact, the spin-down period is exactly what you would guess from general relativity and thereby indirectly measured gravitational waves. That is a long-lived binary which formed in a star system which collapsed under gravitational forces, and will eventually kind of, the orbit will sort of circularize as it winds inward, and energy and angular momentum are lost to gravitational waves. But most of the black hole pairs are not believed to be formed this way. It's thought that if you look at very dense regions in the galaxy, that black holes will actually capture each other in tidal scattering interactions. These are not long-lived binaries that have been orbiting for forever and are slowly circularizing. These are expected to have highly eccentric orbits and possibly very large spins and possibly very off-kilter spins. So the point of this is to say that it's actually these that we expect to see about once per day in the LIGO experiment. So we have to be open to the idea that all the range of the possible orbits will be explored experimentally. And so we have to theoretically understand all of those. So we do need an approach to the two-body problem. I'm not good at telling this joke, but this is kind of like the reaction I got when I first said, but there's one guy hiding and bullets are flying over the podium, and the other guy's shooting his machine gun back, and he says, you know, this symposium has gotten completely out of hand. That's sort of what I felt like when I first started talking about this. For some reason, there was an initially extremely hostile reaction. There's no chaos. It doesn't exist. There's absolutely no chaos. LIGO will never find it. It's not an issue. I have no idea why. I mean, leads you sociologically to an explanation. You can provide it there.
All these people who were happily computing templates
on circular orbits.
On circular orbits, yeah. Assuming that there was no chaos, and they were building software for detectors, constantly monitoring for it. You came along and said, "Wait a minute, none of those templates will work because there's chaos."
Yeah. Well. So oh yeah. Well, the thing is, I didn't exactly say that because most of those templates will work for a large range. I think I have to bear the burden of being kind of unsophisticated about understanding my audience, and so I didn't introduce my papers with lots of caveats about how most templates will work and lots of phase space will be fine. So let me say that now because I'm being recorded. LIGO will be fine. Especially, you know, circular orbits will work very, very well up until the final stages of inspiral, and for sure there's chaos there, but even then it might be so strongly damped, as I'll talk about, that I don't even know if we'll see it, but I'll talk about that later. So anyway, so that's going to be me next week at the MIT Eastern Gravity meeting. On the cartoon?
What you just said, so circular orbits sound very special, but in fact they're not. Mm-hmm. If you consider a system that's been non-lived.
Right, exactly.
Circularized by virtue of radiation reaction.
Right.
So
that's the whole spiel about the Hulse-Taylor pulsar. People thought we were only looking for things like the Hulse-Taylor pulsar, which are lifetime binaries. They were formed together in a two-star system, and they died together, and maybe formed a neutron star in a black hole, or a black hole in a black hole. And surely those will eventually circularize, no matter how eccentric the initial orbit, because they're losing angular momentum to gravitational radiation. However, that's not the largest population that people today argue that we should be looking for. The largest population people argue we should be looking for are these tidally captured black hole binaries. And they are not long-lived binaries, and so they are on highly eccentric, possibly. And also, spin axes are thrown off. All bets are off, basically, in terms of what kind of orbit to expect. They're not predicted to circularize, to my knowledge, by the time of merger, by the time they run into the LIGO bandwidth. So that's exactly was the first argument a lot of people said. Well, first they said there was no chaos, and that was just wrong. And then they said, even if there is, we're not looking for those anyway, because they're all going to circularize. And now nobody's saying that anymore. Okay.
Welcome.
Is this one of those things that I learned in graduate school, where you say, let's discuss this after the talk? Yeah. So what do we know? And you all learned this in your GR class. We know the orbit around a black hole, any black hole, because it was shown through a series of theorems that all black holes would eventually settle down to curved black holes, except for those with charge. Then they're almost like curved black holes with charge. And Carter found geodesics around those curved black holes. So you might think, we do know the orbits around black holes. What I'll tell you is this is actually not a realistic system. First of all, that guy is not spinning. And second of all, it essentially has no mass. But this is what we learned. So I think people are always surprised when you tell them the two-body problems could be chaotic. At least I sort of had to sit down and think about it again. Why? I thought I knew the two-body problem because I knew Carter's solution. But what we really know is everything about the one-body problem. And just to sort of show you where the chaos will come from once I move away from this one-body problem, just imagine I started with the Schwarzschild metric. So I have some curvature in the space-time metric that Schwarzschild found, by the way, under the pressure of warfare. I'm sure you all know the story, right? Schwarzschild was on the Prussian front in a trough, is that the right word? in a ditch, calculating ballistic trajectories, reading the proceedings of the Prussian Academy of Sciences, in which Einstein's new theory of general relativity, or general theory of relativity, rather, was published. And he quickly came up with the solution before dying from an illness contracted in that trench. But my graduate students, I can't get them to do anything like sitting in the comfort of their apartments in New York. No, I'm just kidding. My graduate students are great. I'm just kidding. But he came up with a solution, which is a spherically symmetric solution to black holes, and nobody believed they existed. Einstein didn't believe they existed. He thought the solution was great and fascinating, but that they weren't real astrophysical objects. And it wasn't for another 50 years, I think, that Wheeler coined the term black hole, and he himself started accepting them as the final end state of collapse of a star. But more to the point, we can do a little trick when we try to find geodesics around this, is we can define a Lagrangian. This looks a lot like a Lagrangian, where the T dot means I'm taking the rate of change of all of these coordinates with respect to basically the proper time of the particle. And I can use this Lagrangian to derive a set of equations, and those will give me the geodesic equations. It's a cute little trick for deriving the geodesic equations. I could also define a canonical momentum using this Lagrangian, and I could rewrite it as a Hamiltonian, which I'm going to do because we started discussing chaos and Hamiltonian systems, so I'm just going to make it look like a Hamiltonian. And I could say, okay, I'll forget that this is general relativity. I'm just going to look at this as a dynamical system. And I can derive from Hamilton's equations a list of ODEs and ask, is it integrable? And in the Schwarzschild case, I have four coordinates, that is time, radius r, and two angular degrees of freedom. And there are four conjugate momenta, and I also luckily have four simple constants of motion. You can show that since this Hamiltonian depends nowhere explicitly on time, that pt must be conserved, and that's often coined as an energy of the particle's orbit. And you can see nowhere does this depend explicitly on the phi coordinate, and therefore p phi must be conserved, corresponds to a symmetry, and that corresponds to an angular momentum. And if I choose theta judiciously, I define essentially the equatorial plane to be pi over 2. You see, nowhere here will this ever depend on theta, and theta and p theta is a constant of the motion. That's just, again, an angular momentum conservation, really. And also, we know that particles with any mass travel in time like geodesics, and that gives me a fourth constant. It tells me that basically this Lagrangian is always minus a half, that I'm always on a time-like path. And so with my four constants of motion, I know for sure, even if I can't find that solution, that motion is confined to a four torus and it's perfectly integrable. So orbits around Schwarzschild black holes are perfectly integrable and non-chaotic. And let's just look at what they are. The classic trick is to rewrite this as motion in one dimension. So I have something that looks like a kinetic energy in the radial motion, plus an effective potential, where I've used all of my constants, all my symmetries, to rewrite the Hamiltonian in this way. And so it looks like motion in an effective potential. And I know everybody must remember this from the GR class. The reason why GR is so interesting is because this effective potential has this interesting structure. This is exactly why black holes bend light. If you look at the effective potential not for a time-like orbit, but for a null orbit, and you look at that effective potential, you can see in it the possibility of circular orbits, which you will never see in a Newtonian if I do exactly the same process with a Newtonian system. So it's precisely the appearance of this sort of effective potential structure that makes black holes so interesting. So what do we see? Well, here, and this is just to physically connect with this sort of chaos discussion, I have an unstable circular orbit. If I knock an orbit there, if an orbit sits there, it will have constant radius, and it will just whiz around and fly. So it's a perfectly circular orbit. Here's a circular orbit. And if I knock it, it'll fall inward. And if I knock it outward, it will fall outward. We'll talk about that guy in a second, actually. And a stable circular orbit, and this is the precessing ellipse. Most of the, all the planetary orbits are sitting there in stable circular orbits. And they're not exactly, sorry, they're not circular. They're actually displaced from circular. And when I look at that, I see precession about the circular orbit, and that's all very regular and nice. But there's this third orbit, and this turns out, I won't go into too much detail, but to be the thing that is interesting when you're analytically looking for chaos, and it's called a homoclinic orbit. If I start with the same energy, angular momentum, the same essential constants of motion as this unstable orbit, but I'm at some larger radius here, and I move inward, I will take an infinite amount of time to approach that unstable fixed point. If I start at that unstable fixed point, and I knocked it out, it would take an infinite amount of time to roll away to this point, and then it would come back in after another infinite amount of time. And those are called homoclinic orbits. Homoclinic orbits are orbits that approach the unstable manifold in the infinite past, and the stable manifold in the infinite future. Did I get that right? Yes, they move out along the unstable manifold, and they move in along the stable manifold. Okay, so these orbits are actually, nothing chaotic is going on, but if I'm looking in Poincaré's picture of chaos as the onset of fractal structure of periodic orbits, I know before, this is why I set out to do this problem, that I've got something going on here, that if I perturb this at all, it's very likely I'm going to see chaos right here in this very, very inner region around a black hole. Okay. Oh, and it's interesting also, the homoclinic orbits wind many, many, many times as they approach this circular orbit. And so you'll see things that are nearly homoclinic sometimes, orbits that instead of being on precessing ellipses, as they close inward, they whiz or whirl a bunch of times before they zoom out again, and then they come in and they whirl a bunch of times and they zoom out again. And this is something that I think even though we've all learned about the stable and the unstable periodic orbits, very few people know about these homoclinic guys, but they're actually quite important. Okay. I already said that in words. So here I have a simple set of periodic orbits. There's nothing fractal. There's no what I call the homoclinic tangle. This orbit, homoclinic orbits are nice and smooth. They haven't created any kind of crazy complicated tangle. But we know it's ready. It's just sitting there waiting for something to happen. Now, we also know that spinning the central black hole is not enough because Kerr found those geodesics. Let's say I wasn't doing Schwarzschild, but I was doing Kerr. I was doing a rotating black hole. And again, Carter found those orbits because he found symmetries. There's a time-like killing vector from which we deduce a conserved energy. There's an axial killing vector from which we deduce a constant angular momentum. Things are still time-like. And what Carter did, which was so nice, was he found an extra constant of motion based on a killing tensor. So now we have four constants of motion. Carter did not write down the geodesic solutions, to my knowledge. He just found that fourth constant, and then the story was over. We knew they were integrable. I believe it was Chandrasekhar who solved all of the actual orbits. And they're still quite complex. They get increasingly more complex, but we know that they're not chaotic. Okay, so still, I know I spelled tori with two I's. I meant to fix that, I forgot. I was bugging you last night right before I fell asleep. I know there's only one eye in tori. Okay. So what don't we know? We don't know what happens if the companion spins. So in other words, test particle motion is always based on a non-spinning particle. But that's kind of a silly restriction because we know everything in the universe spins. We see millisecond pulsars. We know the planetary orbits spin. We know the more compact you make them, the faster they spin. And once you put spin on this guy, all bets are off. We no longer know the geodesics. And we also don't know what happens if instead of having a little tiny test particle that is a million times less the mass of the central object, maybe I have two comparable mass black holes. One might be 5 solar masses and one might be 15 solar masses. I no longer know what the geodesics look like or what the orbits look like. All bets are off. And especially if the two spin, that becomes, again, spin is the key. So there are no known exact solutions to these orbits, and the suggestion is that they might show chaos, so we're going to look for it. I'm not going to talk about this very much. I've done some work on these, but I never published anything on it. It was first found by Suzuki and Maeda that indeed, when you add spin and you look at an approximation to how to change the geodesic equations, that you will get chaos in a certain regime. So just, I'm going to talk more about another case, but just really quickly to show you, this is another way of writing the geodesic equations just for comparison in the absence of spin. And here's what happens when you add spin. You have a contraction with the Ricci tensor and antisymmetric tensor over spin vectors. And it lifts the particle off of the geodesic. So the particle, it's as though the particle feels an acceleration. And the spin itself processes. But I'll talk physically about spin in a second. I just want to make the point that these guys did find the chaos. It's very fascinating. But it was kind of ignored. And one of the reasons it was ignored is because they found that the companion had to spin at a rate of around, let's just call it 10 to the 6 in units of the mass of the particle, or more, faster. And that's unphysical. We know that the maximal value for the spin of a particle is 1 in units of mass squared of the particle. So no object spins this fast. You know, a millisecond pulsar spins on the order of 1 times the mass of the neutron star squared. And so even though it was interesting, everyone said, ah, so this is not actually astrophysically relevant. But here's the case that that I did look at where they're both of comparable mass and spinning. And in this case, you do have chaos for realistic spin values in the LIGO bandwidth and all that kind of stuff that you want, or don't want, as the case may be. But what happens here is people have done an expansion to try to find the Hamiltonian for this system. So the point is that we don't know how to write down even the dynamics, even the equations for how two black holes would orbit each other. But what we can write down is an approximation to the equations. And this was done by Damore and other groups. It's very difficult expansions. It takes them many years. When I first did this work, they could only go out to second order. So they take the Hamiltonian. The first correction is the pure Newtonian Hamiltonian. I'm sorry, they start up Newtonian Hamiltonian. The first correction is a post-Newtonian expansion, and the second correction is a second post-Newtonian expansion, and it already is up to almost a page long. And they've just, since I first found chaos, gone to third order in the Hamiltonian. So this is a very difficult process. It's very slowly converging. But they're also able to add spin and ask how spin affects the dynamics. And so what I did basically said, okay, I don't really care where this came from or if it's an approximation or if it's a reality. I'm just going to take this as a dynamical system. As far as I'm concerned, this just is a Hamiltonian. And it's an exact Hamiltonian for something. And I'm going to derive the equations of motion, including the rate of change of the spin, which is given by the Poisson bracket, the Hamiltonian. And you see that there are not enough constants of motion. Now, you might just say, maybe we haven't been clever enough to find those constants of motion. It's not enough to say, hey, I can only think of, you know, energy and angular momentum and spin magnitudes. And I can't think of any others, therefore it's chaotic. Obviously, that's not good enough. There could be constants of motion that we just can't find.
Sorry, just a minute. Don't you mean to talk about expansion or something?
Yes, so it's a Hamiltonian. So you start out with just, you know, G mu nu equals 8 pi T mu nu. You use for T mu nu two black holes, basically point particles, delta functions. And then you don't even know how to write down equations of motion. It's basically, it's an infinite degree of freedom system. Thanks. I'm not going to write down it. I once saw Ed Witten in the whole lecture. He drew a box. And still at the end of the lecture, didn't know what the box was for. I was just about to do something like that. I was just about to draw something like totally abstract like a box. Anyway, so you start with G mu nu equals T mu nu, and you try to just write down equations in a reduced number of variables. So you try to turn off the gravitational waves, and you expand in basically V squared or M on R, where M is the total mass. And you're working in a center of mass set of coordinates. So you have two bodies, the center of mass coordinates, so you only have coordinates R and PR, and the spins, so you have 12 variables. and then the Hamiltonian is a truncated expansion in V squared and R.
So you can prove that this H is chaotic? Is there a guarantee that the full expansion is chaotic?
That's such a good question. I've made noises about that. I'm not going to say it's not a good expansion. I'm just going to say the reason why it's so hard and it keeps, it's, you know, a page long and it's so slowly converging and you're not seeing the nonlinear features that you really see in a real relativistic system. I mean, even at third order, they're just starting to see things like homoclinic orbits and unstable, you know, so I'm not even sure there's homoclinic orbits here when I know that they're in the full relativistic system, stuff like that. There's no doubt people understand that the expansion is very slowly converging and it's not showing all the relativistic features. So even if I find chaos here, my claim is it's the weakest constraint because as it gets more relativistic, it can only get worse.
I mean, in model systems it's small, but it's sometimes you expand and everything is serious. The whole thing gets considerable about the truncation.
That's an excellent question. I've seen that happen. That happened recently. In other words, there's another approach that's not Hamiltonian. In this Hamiltonian system, you can find cases where you definitely don't have chaos because you can count the number of constants of motion. But in a Lagrangian formulation, which is related to this, but it's a truncated approximation to this, you do see chaos for the same system, sort of reduced systems. You can sometimes introduce chaos by truncating the expansion. So that's true, too. Some people argue maybe the chaos will go away. But I know it won't go away because I know it's there in the test particle limit. So the worst it can do is change where it happens in terms of the spin. Okay. I'm hedged in on both ends, is what I'm saying. So you're right, as the expansion gets better, sometimes the chaos might disappear and then reappear. Okay. I'm kind of conscious of the time, but just quickly, what happens when you add spin physically is that if you think about trying to carry the spin vector around, trying to parallel transport some spin vector as you're free falling on this curved space, that's the whole point of a geodesic is that you're in free fall, and you're trying to drag the spin vector with you as you're in free fall. As you're spinning around and the central black hole spinning and you're spinning, what you find is, in effect, the frame has shifted out from underneath you and you are no longer on a geodesic. The spin has to swing around for you to try to remain inertial because you're not actually boosting any rockets or anything like that. And what you find is the spin starts to precess. The gist of it is that the spin starts to precess. So I'm not going to write down the equations of motion, which are hideously long. I'm just going to tell you without proof that what you find in this whole long system is the spin precesses. That's the first thing you find. And that spin precession is a kind of periodic perturbation to your Kerr solution or your Schwarzschild solution. And so if I was doing this like a dynamical systems person, I could use this, use some number theory about my periodic orbits and try to find where the chaos sits. And that's kind of what we're doing now. But what I originally did was more numerical. But you also know that the orbital plane precesses, and that's because the total angular momentum is the sum of an orbital angular momentum, just r cross p, the usual r cross p, and a spin vector, and that is conserved. You do have conserved angular momentum because we've turned off gravitational waves for now. And that causes, that means that the orbital angular momentum changes at a rate that's equal and opposite to the spin. So as the spin precesses, it means the orbital angular momentum must precess. And this means that the whole, what used to be the equatorial plane, precesses. So if we said in general relativity, the orbit of Mars and Mercury precess within a plane, if I really cranked up that spin, I would find that the entire orbital plane precesses too. So now I have a precession of the orbital plane. And that leads to some instability. So very simply, if I look at an orbit in the plane, it used to look like this, but now I might find something like this. Now again, that doesn't mean it's chaotic. Here's an orbit that's not chaotic, but for which I have spin precession. So what I want to know is how do I actually find chaos? I'm going to skip a couple of slides, but we said that chaos leads to extreme sensitivity to initial conditions and to mixing and folding of trajectories into this fractal set of periodic orbits. Some people tried to find chaos by looking at Lyapunov exponents, which are a measure of how quickly two orbits will deviate away from each other in time. And that's not a good measure because time is a relative thing. If I ask different observers who measure space and time differently, they will come up with different answers to the Lyapunov exponent. And this is what plagued the anisotropic Big Bang models originally. People were measuring Lyapunov exponents that were zero in one space-time slicing, and they were measuring positive Lyapunov exponents in a different space-time slicing. They couldn't match these things, and one of the reasons is that Lyapunov exponents are just bad things to use in GR. So we don't really want to use that because Well, I'm kind of going to skip those slides, sorry. We don't want to use those because we want to have a diffeomorphism invariant or an observer-independent way of discussing whether or not there exists chaos. And one thing that we know about all observers is that they agree on events and the crossings of events. And so we try to look for a more topological signal, I guess, is one way of saying it. So let's go back to this idea of the periodic orbits. We said that the periodic orbits under a perturbation, like spin on a black hole, will cause a breakup of the periodic orbits. Basically, they'll start to proliferate and pack very densely in phase space. And we'll have things like homoclinic tangles along that homoclinic orbit. That's what we're guessing is happening. And so, again, it looks like the pinball machine or a game of chaotic billiards. That's what we're saying. Before, it looked like simple periodic orbits that were not sensitive to initial conditions, where everything was very simple and predictable. A pinball game where, as I pulled the lever, exactly how hard I pulled it, I could very easily predict what orbit it would be on. And now we think, well, it's going to be something like this, where I have a whole fractal set of periodic orbits. I don't know where it's going to be in the space phase. And so, what we're looking for are fractals, and it's not a surprise that when you have a proliferating infinity of orbits, they pack into a fractal. You know, the brain is roughly fractal. The idea is that you can pack a lot of information on the surface by making a fractal. So it's proliferating information on the surface without a growing volume. So you're packing all of that in a small space. If we had to have bigger volumes, to have bigger surface areas, we'd still be pretty stupid because our heads can only get so big on the planet. And so in order to have a small cranium but lots of surface area, you make a fractal out of it. And the lungs do something similar with the capillaries. And so we're looking for something here where we have a proliferating infinity of possible orbits packed into a small space. And you might say, how are we going to find a fractal here? Let me just skip that slide. And the way we do is we look for fractal basin boundaries. And this was, again, a technique that Neil Cornish had been using in general relativistic systems I thought was really elegant and really nice. And that was the following. You say, suppose I take that truncated Hamiltonian and I use it to say, these are the orbits of two black holes. So I have a pair of black holes. Each one spins. And I'm going to look at hundreds of thousands of these black holes. And what I'm going to do is just say, I'm going to make a little plane where all the black holes are the same mass, same initial coordinates, the same initial velocities, the same spin magnitudes. The only thing I'm going to vary from orbit to orbit is the displacement angle of the spins. So they might start, both of them spinning up. So the spin angle of one of them versus the spin angle of the other. They both might be at, let's say, that's pi, pointing up, zero. And then I'm going to slowly, step by step, maybe take 200 increments all the way around until I come back again. And I'm going to re-evolve those orbits with every different change in the initial condition. And then I do it again for the other guy. So I have this network of different initial conditions. But the only difference in the initial conditions are small differences in which way the spins are pointed. And then you color code these basins. You say, I'm going to put a black dot on the initial condition if after a certain time, or if the pair merge. If the pair merge, I'm just going to point a black dot, and then I'm going to go to my next orbit, move the spin, run it again. Numerically, and if they execute stable motion, let's say more than 50 or 100 windings, I'm going to color code that initial condition white, and then I'm going to move on. And if they escape from each other, I'm going to color code that initial condition gray, and then I'm going to move on. And you can fill out the plane this way. So let's say I look at that initial condition and that pair merge. I put a black dot, and I move to the next initial condition. And let's say they escape, I point that plot that gray, and I fill out the whole plane this way, the whole initial basin. And this is a case that clearly doesn't show any chaos. There's no mixing and folding of trajectories. There's no fractal. Everything with theta 1 pointing up merged. Everything with theta somewhere in the middle escaped, and everywhere with theta pointing kind of down again, it was stable. But that's not what you find. So if you found something like this, you'd sort of just be surveying. You're saying, I'm not seeing any chaos. I'm not seeing any fractals. I'm not seeing fractal sets of periodic orbits. But instead, what you find is something like this, and it really depends on your black hole mass ratios. You can run this for lots of different kinds of combinations. You find that something like this, where this whole region, they escape. So this is the spin angle of the lighter, the heavier god, I think, in units of radians. And here's the spin angle of the lighter god in units of radians. And all of these basins show areas where the initial conditions led to merger. And in between, I have stable regions. But on the boundaries is where I'm starting to see something that's looking fractal. And this is just like a chaotic scattering problem. It's just like throwing balls on a billiard table and asking, you know, some of these will just fall down the pockets. They're not chaotic. They escape. I don't know, merger, let's call it, they're all pockets. Merger is one pocket. Some of them fall down another pocket. Some of them go a whole long time before they fall down a pocket. And you can do the same kind of basin breakup for a billiard game. But if I look very, very closely at one of these boundaries and I blow it up, I see that I continue to get some kind of sensitivity to the initial condition. No matter how precisely I try to specify the spin angle, I might have some that merge and some that are stable. And I could hone in again and try to blow that up, and again I'd find some that merge and some that are stable, and no matter what scale, eventually it'll cut off, but as you look at finer and finer scale, you really are seeing a fractal. You're seeing a structure that's self-similar, that repeats on smaller and smaller scales. You're seeing exponential sensitivity to initial condition and a mixing and fold of trajectory. So this is an unambiguous signal. It's not just a hint. It's an unambiguous topological signal that there exists chaos. And the Lyapunov exponents, the measures of sensitivity, will be non-zero in some very cleverly chosen space-time slicing, and will correspond, in fact, to the fractal dimension. You can find a relationship between the Lyapunov exponents and the dimension of that fractal. And in certain cases, not yet in the black hole case, although we're working on it, we were able to analytically measure the fractal dimension, analytically find the Lyapunov exponents, and it all comes out and it's all matched by the numerics. So it's pretty wild. Just to show you, if I look at an orbit that's near one of those basins, this is more what it looks like than the simple circular orbits or the precessing ellipses. Here's another one projected on the plane. Here are some others. This is a bit of a cheat, but it doesn't matter. These are actually curved, but that's okay. They're showing a lot of the random motions. Okay, so the orbits do look pretty wild. And because I'm worried about time, I'm going to kind of wrap it up. So where are we with all of this chaos stuff? Well, it is kind of difficult to perceive. For one thing, we've been doing chaos in the absence of gravitational radiation. We've turned off the gravitational radiation. And so we have to really ask, if we're going to ask about, will LIGO see this, or will the gravitational wave experiment see this, whether or not it will survive in the presence of gravitational radiation. And indeed, it is damped. That is, you're in these very inner orbits. And while the chaos might be very strong in the Hamiltonian system, they will begin to merge very quickly as energy is lost to gravitational waves. And that time scale, it's touch and go. They're very closely comparable. So it's unclear whether or not it'll just merge and you'll never see the chaotic episode, or whether the chaos will persist. And one of the reasons why it's not clear is because we can't really solve this two-body problem to begin with. So we're back against the wall that we found ourselves against in the beginning, that until we know better how to discuss the two-body problem, we can't definitively resolve these questions. So the 2PM, the post-Newtonian expansion that we started with, is not relativistic enough. And we might never have an expansion that's quite relativistic enough. And the test particle on a Kerr black hole, by not including the companion's mass, is also not good enough to really tell us where we are. So we're right in the region between the two is what we need to know, and we don't know it yet. But we know there's going to be chaos, and we know there's going to be damping, and we know that they're probably comparable. So in brief, we know that black holes are cool, and they're astrophysical objects. They're real, so this is not just theory noodling around for fun. That they exhibit chaos, and that it's chaos that could be significant for the future experiments. And that there's a larger context, that we saw this kind of chaos in a Big Bang models, in compact dimensions, and color oscillations and moduli oscillations. And even though we haven't really found phenomenological implications of those, they're probably there. We just haven't thought about it well enough yet. And although theoretical physics is a completely reductionist, I don't know if you say discipline. I mean, that's how we're all taught. We're all taught to be reductionists, to look for symmetry, and look for a fundamental theory based on that symmetry. And I'm still curious about whether or not chaos could play a more fundamental role. And there's already suggestions that float around. I'm sure you've heard of where thermodynamics plays a more fundamental role. The laws of the thermodynamics of black holes and black hole areas being hints and clues and entropies around black holes. And could chaos also play some role there that we don't understand, where emergent phenomena is relevant to fundamental physics? And so I kind of wondered if we could start with a theory, I mean, toy models of theories that don't have symmetries. And instead of saying, therefore, it's just a lousy theory, could we look at something where we ask, does anything emerge? Does any kind of phenomena emerge that would deceptively look like a symmetry of the system? And having thrown that out there, don't ask me what I mean by that. but I'm hoping somebody else will know what I mean by that. Thank you.
I know that Eric has things to say, and why don't we start with?
Yeah, just questions. So they may exhibit chaos, but I'm sure if you really establish that chaos does take place in a realistic, you know, two-battle system with energy dissipation and all that. But I just wanted to ask you a few things about, first of all, the issue of do you perceive. So you're using a post-Newtonian expansion, mm-hmm. and of course we don't believe that this expansion is that you perceive too hard.
Right.
Think that we perceive beyond point one and all too hard.
Right.
So do you find that you find chaotic behavior beyond this limit?
No, that's an important question. You do, just to emphasize, you do find chaos in the purely relativistic system where there's no expansion. So we know that in some extreme mass ratio case that the post-Newtonian expansion should mimic that behavior. And if it doesn't, it's just because it's being a poor expansion of the full relativistic problem. So what can I tell you? Usually you are pushing to a regime where the post-Newtonian expansion is poor. You are, for sure. But so are all the other templates. So in other words, when I first took this, I said, look, let's just take this as a dynamical system, because that is how it's being treated. And yes, it is very poor approximation when you're in at those very inner orbits where you're seeing all the nonlinear dynamics. And you should probably be pushing to higher order in your expansion. But you can't say, you cannot make the argument that it is solely a result of a truncated expansion, because in the extreme mass ratio limit, it should reproduce what I see in the curve case.
Okay, so I'm not making this conclusion, but it was my understanding that the spinning particle in the curve, I think 3 or 4 years ago, there was a student at Caltech who looked at this. Look at this very thoroughly. I don't think he was able to find chaos.
Oh, no, he definitely found chaos for the current. He did. He found positive Yalkin effects on it. That's what he did to measure it.
Yeah, but my recollection is that he found a lot of ambiguity in determining those Yalkin effects.
Not as I remember, he just found that the spins were very large, but they already knew that. Maeda and Suzuki, his work he was talking about, already knew that the spins had to be kind of unphysically large. That is, one in units of reduced mass times total mass, which is not really one in units of reduced mass squared. It's much bigger than that. Okay, so Hartle found the same thing. But Hartle reproduced the same kind of Lyapunov experiment on the two-body problem of the post-Newtonian expansion, and did find positive Lyapunov exponents. Now they kind of argue it's in
the scientific world.
Both Kerr, he did it in Kerr, and then he redid it in, Neil Cornish and I found positive Lyapunov exponents in the post-Newtonian expansion in a Lagrangian formulation. Then Hartle and Buonanno also found positive Lyapunov exponents in a Hamiltonian expansion. So they also confirmed it. But they think it's a very small region of phase space. So the question we're up against is not so much, you know, I don't think anybody doubts that there's chaos anymore. It's there in Hamiltonian dynamics for sure. I don't think people argue about that anymore, although they did. I think what they argue now is, well, maybe it's very, very few orbits, it's a very small region of phase space, and chaos will damp it. And I say, yeah, maybe. No, I don't think we know yet, because we can't do the expansion well enough.
So what does an observation mean for someone who's sitting at LIGO? So that question is, so they usually look at these orbits in sort of three phases, the spiral and then something massive, yeah, and then the ring down or something like that.
Yeah.
So this sort of stuff in this massive phase.
Yeah, it's not as bad as the plunge phase, which is actually in a way easier to understand, because as you said, you can model it's a ring down with a curve.
Right.
But it's sort of, it's not the nice in spiral phase. It's at the end, the chirp, basically. Imagine the chirp.
Right.
Usually when you see people draw gravitational waves, they look like this, and the amplitude gets larger,
right,
and then it starts to chirp. It gets really wild. This chirping phase, when you're in the final stages of in spiral and you're really starting to merge, is where you might see the chaos.
But then you just don't see anything. Is that, I mean, the observation of the thing would be, what would it be? So you see this, in spiral phase,
no,
and then basically it's just noise.
Well, the chirp, a lot of people thought the chirp was extremely important to extract in a gravitational wave. Because, it's not like, this is not the case. It's not like I go, oh, look, I can hear, you know, I've got my template matching and I can hear a gravitational wave.
Right.
You basically have to match over all of the cycles,
right,
to say, I've got enough cycles to pull the signal above the noise. And a lot of people were saying this chirp is actually really important to that matching. It's not like, oh, I matched in real time and now I'm losing it. But it's unclear. I mean, to be honest, I don't really. This is one of the things. There's a LIGO experimental group at Columbia, and we're working on, could we detect these, and could we think of a way of detecting it? And I'm gonna say something like this. That it, first of all, the chaos or no chaos. I'm gonna say we're trying a dynamic systems approach to this whole problem. So we're saying, who cares if it's chaotic, actually? Because even if it's just Kerr, it's still really complicated, and we still have an infinite set of templates. And so what we're doing now is we're saying, I don't care if it's really chaotic or not chaotic anymore. That's been established, or maybe, you know, all I really want to know is, how do I match a template? And we know we have things like circular orbits and processing ellipses, and we have things out of the equatorial plane. So what we're doing is we're trying to use things like, these are rational windings, real orbits are irrational, how close is irrational to a rational, what's the instability exponent? It's not really a Lyapunov exponent, it's just asking about fixed points, good old-fashioned dynamical systems theory. And we're trying to build a taxonomy of orbits where I can tell you how to match the filter based on things like, what's the stability of the fixed point, how near is it to a fixed point, how irrational is a winding. And that reduces the number of parameters I'm looking for, like, dramatically. I no longer have an infinite set of orbits, I simply have periodic ones and things that I know how to discuss near them. But the periodic aren't circular. They could be totally out of the plane, they could be homoclinic. By looking at the dynamical systems more deeply, we're able to say, oh, the periodic orbits aren't just circular. And that's allowing us to totally, am I making any sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So now, right now, actually, we're less caught up in the whole issue of whether or not it's formally chaotic. And we're just trying to use dynamical systems theory to say, I can track this using that thinking, and I could follow it all the way through the chirp. That's the hope. I mean, we're not there
so
yet.
So the basic picture remains.
In terms of template matching, you mean?
No, sort of these phases.
Yeah, that would still remain so very, very far apart, even two very rapidly spinning comparable mass black holes, if they're 100 or 1,000 apart in units of total mass or in units,
right,
of horizon radii, will look like processing ellipses or even more Newtonian. And it will only be, you know, it really depends on the masses of the two objects, how much of the instable period will be in LIGO. You can kind of tweak it depending on the masses. So the answer is I could tweak one to make the masses a certain ratio, and that will end up in LIGO, you know, where the chaos or the dynamical system stuff would be more important before the chirp. But no, I guess it's fair to say it's always pretty close to the chirp. So yes, that basic picture remains. Although, sorry, I'm going to take it back. With these homoclinic guys, where they kind of go like this,
right,
you know, you don't chirp until the final stage, and you do see these stages before the chirp. And you see them periodically. You see a phase of something really interesting, and then it looks really weird, normal, and then it comes in again, and then it looks normal, and then it comes in again. And so I think the reality is the real orbits are so complicated that we're trying to look at all of the different possible periodicities now. And the reason why I'm kind of stumbling is because I don't have the full taxonomy of the orbits yet.
Okay, other questions?
cards. Well, good. Well, thank you. Chad, unfortunately, he is just here today and set up tomorrow morning, but and then she goes on to see that, but we hope she comes back. Thank you very much.
Thanks.